This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 227 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by Canvas People. CanvasPeople.com has a very easy-to-use photo-to-canvas service that takes your favorite photo memories and turns them into beautiful artwork for you to enjoy every day. Instead of snapping that beautiful photo and letting it rot in your cell phone, you can bring that photo to life to put it on your walls at home, in your office, or to give as a gift. Speaking of photos rotting in your cell phone, like, I still to this day have photos in my phone from when we went to Scotland in 2015. And because I had those pictures in my phone when we were introduced to Canvas People, I was able to turn my favorite shot from Scotland into a beautiful 11 by 14 canvas from Canvas People.
And guess what I did?
The same thing.
My favorite photo from Scotland was Summer's photo as well as her favorite photo, but she took it. So yeah, so it is such a no-brainer. You have these photos everywhere, maybe on your hard drive, maybe, you know, on your phone now, online sharing site, online photo site. You have so many things, and we're always trying to make sure that we back up and don't lose our data. But when it comes to photos, there's a reason you took it. Something maybe to document, but also to remember these very special times. Maybe it's someone who's passed or a beloved pet or a wedding, your own wedding. You know, there's so many reasons to capture some of your favorite shots and have them brought to Canvas.
You can buy with confidence because CanvasPeople.com has served over 1 million customers.
It's made right here in the U.S. and there is extremely fast shipping. Really, believe me, ridiculously fast shipping, and there is such great attention to detail.
Now, normally 11 by 14 canvases are priced at $69.99, but there is a limited time offer for one free 11 by 14 canvas. You just pay shipping.
For our listeners, as Summer said, there is this offer, and the way to take advantage of it is to go to canvaspeople.com and use promo code Outlander. Again, that's an 11 by 14 canvas for free if you just pay shipping by going to canvaspeople.com using promo code Outlander. And now a little bit of listener feedback for episode 311, Uncharted. First, let's hear from Eileen P.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Eileen P. from Melville, New York. I know the writers really had to streamline a mammoth-sized book in order to adapt it for TV. I know some people despair when their favorite line from the book is left out in the show. I know they are upset when characters from the book don't show up where they should on the show. I know they are sad when characters from the book are cut completely from the show, their tasks given to another, or cut altogether. I am sad there was no Rothschild to aid Jamie and Claire before their rescue mission set sail. I am sad there was no Stern to rescue Claire or have a Grange moment reunion with Jamie. If Stern, the naturalist, had been there, he would have warned Claire about the ants. For that alone, he should be missed. However, it's not just about the actions of these missing characters. I'm upset about the cutting out of Jews from the tapestry of Outlander's 18th century world. The way the storylines on the TV show were adapted from the book left little for underlying themes. While the show tells of the separation of Jamie and Claire, their reunion, and then the adventure to find young Ian, the book has more depth than this storyline. In the book, there is an underlying theme of being an Outlander, a foreigner, an outsider. Even in her own time, Claire is an Outlander. Whether it's that she really belongs in the 18th century with her soulmate, or is a female doctor shattering a glass ceiling, Claire is an Outlander. She's an Outlander befriending Joe, another Outlander. Jamie is an Outlander post-Culloden, no longer a lard or a warrior. He is suddenly a recluse, a prisoner, and at one point a servant in England. There is the obvious outlander, Mr. Willoughby, who expresses his frustration in a heartfelt telling of his story. Even Father Fogden is an outlander. How many priests do you know who have fled into exile with a woman and her mamacita? So with this bunch, I'm missing Rothschild, the outlander, and Stern, the outlander. I'm missing seeing how they are treated in this outlander world, and how Jamie and Claire treat and interact with them. I miss the use of the arts to open our eyes about the more difficult issues we face in society. I miss learning the stories of the outlanders and seeing how their lives are affected by being an outlander. Perhaps the show's writers softened Mr. Willoughby so much that there was no longer a significant outlander theme. Perhaps the streamlined storyline rendered Rothschild and Stern unnecessary. That decision to make them unnecessary makes me sad. I think an opportunity was missed.
Next up, Megan M.
Hello there. Megan from Memphis, Tennessee. Summer, you always do such a good job pronouncing my name. It actually is pronounced Pesci. You do it right every time. Is that I enjoyed it immensely. It was excellent. And there were so many comical moments in this episode, which was so nice. There's been a lot of very serious and kind of disheartening moments the last couple of episodes. And so it was nice to have some happiness to end the episode on a good note. A funny note, the wedding and Father Fogden and Marcelie and everyone was just great and definitely loved it. I am so worried about the last two episodes because I just like, how can they fit all of it in, you know? Because I just recently read the book again just because I was trying to figure out how they were going to fit all this in. But I do feel like they adapted this most recent episode very well. So I have faith that they're going to do an excellent job on the last two episodes, even though I wish there were 16 episodes instead of 13. But I'm excited about where they're going to end up and am enjoying Drums of Autumn as I've started reading and am looking forward to submitting my feedback for that as well. So you ladies have a great afternoon, and I will, until next time, bye.
Martina P. writes, loved this episode with all my heart. The only thing I would change is to reduce the beginning by 5 minutes and add it to the turtle soup scene. I am such a sucker for Jamie and Claire togetherness. My favorite scene was the wedding with Father Fogden. Loved the actor's portrayal. He was just crazy enough and not slightly over the top as in the book. His pronunciation was flawless in both French and Spanish. Super handsome Fergus and fiery Marsali have great on-screen chemistry, and this couldn't be more adorable. I loved Jamie and Claire kissing in the background, giving Fergus and Marsali center stage in this scene. What a sweet moment when Jamie gives Fergus his name. Words elude me. The smiling glance at Jamie, dear Lord, so emotional. It was just one of the most brilliantly adapted scenes in my mind. Great episode, loved all the adaptive changes. Now I am ready to find young Ian because I adore this actor's portrayal like nobody's business. And finally, Michael M.
Howdy, Ginger. Howdy, Summer. This is Michael from Shawnee, Kansas. Let's talk about time. First, I think I would have enjoyed Survivor Claire more had I not been a book reader. Knowing how much story remains and how little time there is to portray it, I was a little impatient with this part of the episode. I agree with the statement that the encounter with the snake was not really needed to sell me on the dangers of the wild. Second, the two of you spent a considerable amount of time analyzing the time it took for Claire to run to the beach. When I was watching Jamie and the remaining crew make progress on the beach, it seemed like Claire was hardly making any progress towards it. This reminded me of the swamp castle, you know.
That burned down, fell over, then sank into the swamp, but the fourth one stayed up.
When Sir Lancelot is charging towards the castle, every time the cut shows his advance, it seems like he's not making any progress at all. Third, I have a theory about the stone's effects on time and space in the Outlander universe, and you can find it in the Facebook group. By the way, the Outlander universe is the realm of the show. The books are part of the Dianaverse, which spawned off the Outlander universe, and we all reside in the Fanverse, which is blessed with the sisters Ginger and Summer. My final thought with this feedback is, while he is no Elias Pound, Coco did bring me a sense of je ne sais quoi.
And now, on to our discussion of episode 312, entitled The Bakra.
So just so you guys know, it may not come across at all. It may be completely not needed, unneeded completely. But I am having a little bit of whiskey, or maybe more than a little bit of whiskey.
Y'all, she sent me a picture. It's not a little bit of whiskey.
Let's go on. So this
she
episode.
She put a straw in the bottle.
It's like two shots or something.
One of those crazy long squirrely straws.
No, I did not. Do not
spells
lie.
Spells out Scotland.
Stop bottle. It. It's a bottle. It's a whiskey snifter. Summer. It's not a bottle. I don't have a straw that long. This episode 312. Oh my gosh, just one more.
I don't want to talk about it. Don't say that.
I know. It's called The Bakra. It's written by Luke Shellhaus and directed, as was 311, Uncharted by Charlotte Brandstrom. So Summer, where again did 311 leave us off?
311 left off with everybody back together and on their way to Jamaica.
That's right. They got married, they got back on the boat, and they're everybody except young Ian, but yeah.
And turtle souping. And they were turtle souping it.
That's right. That's how it ended. It ended.
Because that's a verb now.
Turtle souping. In this episode, we get another cold open. We flash back to the day when young Ian was taken from Selkie Island. His captors captured him and took the chest, and they looked into the chest. They didn't do much, but they looked. And we learn of a mysterious being called the Bakra. And that the Bakra seeks something in the jewels or in the chest. We also learn that the Bakra likes young boys. And thankfully, too. Otherwise, young Ian would have been served to the pigs on board. And then magically, we are taken to Jamaica by some outdoor shots.
If you looked away from the screen for like a hot second, you thought that entire scene with the Bakra was inside the boat. Because that's what I thought the first time I watched it. I was like, what just happened? They have a blood pool inside of the boat? I was very confused. And then I rewound it and I was like, oh, I missed this shot where they were showing the location.
Everything up to the location shot was on the ship.
Exactly. I missed the location shot the first time. And
so
I was like, what's happening?
You thought the prison part was on the ship
too? Yes. I was like, I don't understand.
That would have been actually pretty. Well, hey, she said it was goat's blood and the porpoise had goats. So why not? Okay, so we are in Jamaica. Jamaica. Okay, young Ian and his shipmates have arrived. He is put into prison or thrown into prison. And I don't think Ian said it. I think it was the captor dude or the guy who put him in there. Let the Bakra know we've arrived. She'll be well pleased. Surely that wasn't young Ian.
I doubt it.
Okay, so now we know the Bakra is a she. Because look, just because you like young boys doesn't mean you're a she.
As evidenced by season one and two.
Especially number two. So, did you note the music when he's talking about the Bakra? It's very dissonant. It's kind of funky town. We'll come back to this. So, of course, that funky town dissonance means danger of some kind. Death, danger, life, limb. You never know. At least
Bakra.
At least something negative, right? So young.
Did anyone look up Bakra to see what it really stands for? I feel like I need to.
Summer likes to call it Bakara.
I do not. That is a lie. I've never said that.
You just told me like 3 days ago.
You said Baccarat and I said it's not Baccarat.
I did not. I said Baka. I couldn't think of the name. I thought there was an A after the K sound and you said it's not Baccarat. I'm like, I didn't say Baccarat, Summer. You did. But I hear it's a nice game.
No, let's see. Bakra. Oh, okay. Bakra in British Caribbean, noun plural. White person, especially one from Britain. So all it's saying is it's a white lady.
Oh, interesting. Okay, we'll have to add. Send me the link. So young Ian has a cellmate. His name is Henry. From him, we learned that there had been other boys too, once. And yep, he confirms that they are in Jamaica. There is also a young black boy there. And Henry says that he was there when he himself arrived. I gotta say, It's not that I never thought he was good, because we haven't had a ton of screen time with him, but I thought John Bell did really, I just, for the little time he was given, I thought he was extremely effective. So again, casting directors, like, this is one of the best cast shows I've ever seen. And not just because people are pretty or not, as appropriate to their character type. They can act well, all that stuff, as you would hope for. But again, even though it's an adaptation, it's, and I'm not even talking about they look like the people we think they do in the books. I'm not even talking about looks-wise, like, oh, they don't have blue eyes or blonde hair. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying they embody the character. Even given the changes, even given the adaptation, my point is casting has been a dream. So John Bell is good. That's my point. I really like his acting chops. Now, one by one, these others, the boys who used to be there, had been taken to see the Bakra and never came back. So what is the Bakra? I mean, Summer just told us, but in the episode, you probably didn't Google it right away, or maybe you did. We'll have to wait and see. And then we see some more outdoor images to set the scene. The final one before we see young Ian taken in to see the Bakra is of what we come to find out is Rose Hall. And you know what? Book readers will or should know this if you've been around for a little while. That's what I mean. Because if you've read the book like last this summer, you may not have known this. There actually is a Rose Hall in Jamaica, and there's a legend about a white witch associated with Rose Hall in Jamaica. And we'll share that link in our show notes. So a slave comes to take young Ian into a room, a bedroom. And there he sees, or at least the camera sees, him seeing a foot lift up covered in blood.
We
see a foot to start with. Duncan. He sees a lot more. And then we see a lot more.
Whatever her name is.
And who is it going to be?
She's another one I've never quite, even though I hear them say it all the time. Well, not so much since season one, but I hear the name, but I still can't, because in my brain I see how it's spelled and it makes no sense to me that I still don't pronounce it right. It's like Leary or Lyra, whatever.
Well, okay. The word that means like party is Kaylee, right? Kaylee. That's C-E-I. So the E-I sound is A. So it's Galus. Okay. A very naked Galus Duncan Bakra climbs out of the pool of goat's blood. She says, I am the Bakra, but you can call me Galus. As she was walking around, did you have like a little flashback or whatever you call it? Like a little reminiscent of Carrie?
I mean, not until you just said that, but I can see why you would. Though she needed it on her face. And I want to know how she kept her face so youthful.
Well, that's true.
Or did she only bathe her face in goat's blood in private when there weren't people coming?
Maybe so. That's true. Because that would have been a little scarier when you see the face.
Because I mean, don't get me wrong. For how old she was supposed to be, her body was like kicking. I'm just thinking that her face was like completely unlined. The only aging they did on Galus was blonding her red hair.
They lightened her hair, and they did something to her face. They didn't add like...
They gave her an ugly wig at the Jamaica party. That's it.
Well, that's not the face. That's the head. But they definitely did the hair. But they did something, and I didn't like freeze frame and compare it to young Galus, but her skin did not look as luminescent as it did in season one. So she's definitely different. Obviously, it's makeup. But they didn't give her jowls or anything, but they definitely gave her some softening. Maybe not in her body. You could tell there was just as it was for Katrina, it was extremely subtle, but very effective. I thought effective, but you know, you can almost tell she's a dancer as she walks around naked, covered in blood. She is so stinking graceful. And of course her body, a dancer's body. She's so lithe. And as she's pouring the second jug of water over her to rinse off the blood, young Ian looks, did you notice this? He looks on and he licks his lips.
I did not notice that.
I was like, wait, what? Did you just... I mean, he's scared, but he's still a dude. I wonder if this was on purpose. I wonder if he was like, if John Bell even recognized he was doing that. And I thought, I wonder even if in his fear, was he lusting after her? I mean, he is in fear for his life, but, you know, Jamie did say that, in the books at least, maybe in the show, I don't remember, that before a battle, like fighting gives you a raging cock stand or something like that. Terrible cock stand. I don't know. So as Summer said, and as we discussed, Galus has aged very well. A slave brings in a plate of goodies for young Ian, and the Bakra tells young Ian to eat before she answers his questions. He's starving, having not eaten on the long journey from Scotland.
I'm sure he ate a little bit. They just didn't feed him well.
I was waiting to see how long it would take.
I was like, that's silly. I'm sure he did not eat since Scotland. That's ridiculous.
I know. I said it on, I have actually wrote it on purpose. I'm like, I'm going to see what she
You're
says.
A nerd.
He ate like he hadn't eaten since Scotland, basically. Now that I look back, I can see that the reason that she was trying to sweeten him up, you know, quote unquote, sweeten him up, was to get him to make sure that he drank the tea, because the tea was either herbal or had something in it that made him drugged tea or something.
Well, and clearly he was more concerned going in about the food. He didn't even think about it. He seemed like he was like, are you going to poison me? But he's like, oh, tea.
Exactly. So, but as she's offering the tea, she's like, oh, you know, you might want to here add a little sugar to it. It makes it go down better. It's, you know, it helps. So then she gets to the point. She says, out of the blue, quite frankly, there were only two sapphires in that box. Did you take the other one? And he replies with his mouth full of cake. And then she complains, oh man, that cake, it is too dry, or better than me, but whatever. And meanwhile, waiting for him to answer, she takes her hair down and she's trying to be all seductive. And he had basically said his first reply, as his mouth was full of cake, was basically, your men took me before I could do anything. I haven't even hadn't even opened it. And then she says the thing about the cake being dry, urges him to drink more tea, and then says, again, did you take the jewel? And he says, no, I told you, woman, I did not take your ding-dong jewel. And then he feels the tea begin to affect him. And he says, maybe my uncle took the jewel.
And then he slaps his hand over his mouth like, whoops.
I mean, that is like, I know. I mean, I know it's fiction and I know it's Hollywood, but I'm thinking, and I know it's 18th century. It's not like, you know, 21st century science. But I'm thinking, really? Even if you had something that made you loosey-goosey, mm-hmm. you know, loose-lipped. Does it really, like, take you by surprise like that? You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I've never experienced anything like that. But I thought it was funny. And then she says, yeah, the witch doctor makes the tea for me.
Convenient.
Very convenient.
I need a witch doctor.
Dude, I need a few. And then she says, who's your daddy? I mean, your uncle.
She didn't say that.
I know that, Summer. I'm having fun. Plus, I've had a little bit of whiskey.
No more whiskey for you.
I am reading, though, I promise you. So he answers again, James Fraser. Dude, like, I don't know. Whatever this truth serum is, I want to know who makes it, where it is, so I can make sure to maybe have a little stash on hand for those convenient opportunities, but also to stay the heck away from it, to know what it tastes like. Actually, it is, I think, a good idea to taste it. To know what it is, I know it's fake, but to have an idea of what it tastes like and what it does to you, so that if, God forbid, something ever happens to you, not like this, but someone trying to ply you with this loosey-goosey tea, you know from first taste what it is and you can stop. Oh, Summer.
I mean, this entire interchange to me is the culmination of all of the teensy tiny butterfly effects.
Tiny?
That, yeah, I mean, the little tiny changes made in the beginning of the season and all of the changes they had to make to push through with them and still be able to get to their end goal. This whole conversation that she had with him, of course it didn't happen in the book. In the book, she didn't even know it was Ian Murray. She didn't know that it was Jamie's nephew. I'm just saying, the only mention of witch doctoring nonsense, not nonsense, but witch doctoring things in the book was to do with the zombie potions that she was...
The twin slaves.
Yeah, that she was giving to make them more pliable, right? Or malleable.
Hercule, uh-huh. Hercule and his twin. I forget the dude. I don't know the other guy's name, but it was Hercule, uh-huh. Her strong man, basically.
So not completely out of the realm of possibility given the source material.
Ah. Okay, hold on a second. Given the source material, They could have gone to the moon. I mean, yeah, it could have been a lot. I don't want to say worse because it's not bad. It could have been a lot more, a lot more.
For sure. But that was one big change they had to make. I think that I was concerned when they hit Jamaica and they hit the party the first time when Willoughby was getting attention. And I know I'm jumping ahead here, but Willoughby was getting attention from the woman.
Oh, yeah.
At the party. I was concerned that they were going to try to jump back on the Willoughby killed somebody bandwagon from the book. And I was like, how are they going to jump back into that? I was like, because they didn't even talk about the murderer in Edinburgh from the book. So I started to get concerned that that was the way they were going to go with it. And then when they had him hitting on Margaret, I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. What? I was like, it was cute. I enjoyed it. I liked the little interaction between those two actors. And I thought it was very sweet, but I was like, what's going on? I felt like a non-book reader watching this episode.
Did you hear that, dear listener? That was Summer speaking, not Ginger.
What are you saying?
I agree with you completely.
I'm not ranting.
I didn't say you were ranting. I'm just saying your observations. You're also like, WTF, but okay, let's go.
I mean, I'm on board. I just have moments where I'm like, why?
Oh, we're on board. It's Voyager. We're all aboard. So back to the Bacra and the Bobo. John Bell has a really great profile, by the way. It reminds me of Katrina's. It's very strong. His nose and his profile reminded me of Katrina. So what does the Bacra do with boys?
Are you asking me or are you just saying that for effect?
I mean, it's rhetorical. We can talk about it. It's rhetorical. She does have her way with them. Now, I'm wondering, okay, since when Ian got there and Henry, who was in the cell with him, said that there had been six boys total and now they were all gone except for him and the slave boy. He named him, but I couldn't understand the name even to transcribe it. And that they were all gone. It was funny that Ian was taken first because the other dude, I mean, it doesn't matter. I was like, oh, whatever. So we have no idea of how much time passed between there being no other boys and then Ian arriving. But even if it had been, you know, a few days or a few months, whatever, I'm guessing that, I don't know. Do you believe that the blood was goat's blood? I mean, we have no reason to disbelieve her except for the fact that
she's a liar.
She's a liar everywhere, all the time, all the times, and like whatever time period. And all the places. So she's a liar, period. That's not up for discussion. But in the book, we don't get it. We don't get this exact scene. We don't even get exactly what happens. It is so bad, however, in the book, it is so bad that when Ian is rescued, and it's not a spoiler. I mean, I guess he could be killed, but we'll see. We'll see if they kill him off in the show. In the book, he's rescued. But when he's rescued and he's retelling his capture and what happened, a lot of it, not all of it, but, you know, a good, like the big stuff to Jamie, not Claire, just his uncle. Jamie refuses later on when Claire's like, is everything okay? Was it bad? And Jamie's like, it was bad. Jamie refuses to tell Claire. It was that bad. And Jamie tells Claire almost everything. So what we're led to believe, first of all, we don't know exactly, but what we're led to believe is that she slept with the virgins to get their power, whatever that was. And then she killed them. She said as much in the episode. So that's because she says it's not a bad way to go. So does she slit their throats as they're having an orgasm? Who knows?
A black widow or a praying mantis where she pulls their heads off post-coital.
Oh, Lord. Well, however it is, she says it's not a bad way to go. So I'm thinking it happens as they copulate or at the end. Because if you do it and then she kills you afterwards, that is a freaking bad way to go. But if you do it does it make sense? If she does it or if they die during coitus, then I could see, okay, maybe that's not a bad way to go. You know what I'm saying? As far as maybe they lose consciousness, who knows? But in the book, she used the virgins. I don't know if it was once or more than once. We don't know. But after she was done with them, we got the hint, the very strong hint that she definitely, like it was blurry bloody. It's up to the viewer to decide, you know, was it truly goat's blood? Because that was a lot of blood. Or was it, that was a pretty deep pool for her to be sitting in or tub. Or was it, actually probably was goat's blood because I don't know how many humans you need to fill that up. I mean, come on.
Well, humans only got what? 8 pints of blood? 4.7 to 5.5 liters.
To five.
How many
five.
Pints?
Let's say five-ish.
8 pints of blood for the average person.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So a five-foot person weighing half that would be, so 50 kilograms, so like 100 and something pounds, would be 6 to 8 pints. So the average body, a five-foot person is teensy though. That's not, 5 foot is not
average.
That's
why I'm saying 8 pints.
5 foot person though.
5 foot person is between 6 and 8.
So a 5 foot eight person like myself would be like probably between 8 and 10. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a scientist about that. So, but I can go with eight is possible. Absolutely. So I'm happy to say 8 for a somewhat small person. So yeah, between
an average,
5 foot's not average. A small person, I would say that. A small person, about 5 foot, would be between, did I say five and eight?
6 and 8.
6 and 8 pints of blood. Okay, so let's say it was a huge person and they had 10 pints of blood. That was still more than 8 pints of blood, 10 pints of blood. That was gallons, because that was a bathtub. And she was like, we saw her getting up out of it. It was like up to her boobs, right?
Yeah, I don't know how deep it was, but it was definitely like sittable.
Okay.
It's the amount of blood in a goat.
Oh, Lord.
What is that? I mean, it's going to be less.
Let's talk about all the kinds of sideways this show takes. Let's go.
Blood volume of normal animals.
Oh, Lord. That's going to be on your Google history. How many pints of blood? Pints of
I'm on the list,
blood
y'all.
In a goat.
Did you just type that?
Yes.
Why? You want to join me?
Sure. The blood volume in most mammals is approximately 7 to 9% of ideal body weight. Oh, ideal body weight. Oh, because the rest of it's fat. Got it. Thank you, Google. Thanks for that. If your 7 foot giant weighed 100 kgs, they would have a blood of 7 to 9 liters. Oh God. So 50. Okay. I don't know. A 5 foot person weighing half that. Oh, seriously. I Googled goats and I still get the same damn link that Summer got.
Hang on. Animal blood volumes from the animal blood.
I found it too.
Animal blood resource. Let's see.
There's a goat in there. Hang on. A kitty. 8.5 ounces. My baby. No,
but a Labrador retriever has 5 pints. So I would imagine they're probably the size of a Labrador retriever.
I can go with that. So let's say 4.5 to 5.
Holstein, she should be using cows. Cows have 10.3 gallons. She could probably fill her tub with a cow.
What a father. Do you know how many gallons? Well, I don't even know. Let's look it up. How many gallons? This is ridiculous. How many gallons of water in
like an average tub?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's going to be smaller than an average tub. A very small bathtub might hold 40 gallons, while a larger single-person bathtub could easily hold 100 or more. So let's say it's a small bath. Let's say it's 40 gallons. Let's just say it's 40 gallons.
Okay, so if it's 40 gallons, we need 4 cows.
How many goats?
If it was Labrador retrievers,
have
liters. How many liters are in a gallon?
Oh, God, you're going to make me convert. Liters.
4 liters? 4 liters? Four
no,
quarts.
That's a quart.
How many
convert?
4 quarts in a gallon. How many pints are in a quart?
Okay. How many liters do you say?
5 liters. Oh, that's a human. 2.3
liters. 2.3
liters.
That's 0.6 gallons.
So you'd need 0.6 times 40. You'd need like 50 goats to get a 40 gallon tub full.
So let's do 40 divided by 0.6?
No.
Sure. Yeah. You need 66 goats.
I was close.
Plus. What did you say, 50?
I said 50.
Yeah, it's not bad, actually.
Yeah, they might have been big goats.
Okay, so let's return to the episode. So my guess, or not even a guess, it's if it's goat's blood and that was a very small tub, she would need approximately 50 to 60 goats. I mean, she probably had it. She's a rich bitch, so she's a rich bakra.
Mm-mm.
But we can probably rule out the fact that it was the virgins, because if it were the virgins, number one, they were dead more than one day. They were gone more than a day. They didn't miraculously disappear the day before he arrived. But even if they had six, not even a six, there were two there. So 4 were missing, right? So 4 times, even say a big guy, say 10, and 10's a lot. 4 times 10 is 40. So even 40 liters. Let me go back to converting. So let's say 40 liters still gets you 10 gallons. That's a quarter of what she would have needed in that tub. So unless it's like virgin light, like it's a sprinkling of virgin and mostly goat, there's no virgin blood there.
I mean, how long can she keep the blood?
That's what I was about to say. Let's say it was all virgin blood.
What's the shelf life?
Let's say she had a ton of virgins. It would have coagulated.
Is there an anticoagulant that they have in Jamaica that she could use?
Oh, Lord. You're going to make me look that up, Summer. Anticoagulant herb. Herbal supplement herbs. So it's called a blood thinner. Oh, okay. So there's garlic, ginkgo, ginseng. So absolutely there were possibilities. Don't know. And she was an herbalist, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
Mother, father. Maybe she knew enough. Obviously, it wouldn't last forever, but maybe she knew enough to keep it going for a little bit before it got furry.
Furry.
It would have grown some mold. We're pretty sure it's not the boys. It might be goats, more likely cows.
Or horses. Or elephants. Elephants have lots of blood.
Lord Summer. I don't think they brought an elephant to the island.
All she would need is one African elephant. 65 gallons.
So thankfully, due to the tea, Gillis believes him when he says that it's his uncle and he doesn't know anything more. But it's kind of funny. Like, joke's on you, Bakra. He's actually not lying to get out of getting killed because he knows he's probably going to be killed anyway. And you know that he's not lying because you just gave him that tea. So go on, girl. Okay. So she considers, and we see that Gillis can go with the flow. So what does she do with the boys? I kind of talked about that already. But what she tells Ian is that she has her way with them and they're virgins all. And then after she's done, she has no use for them. And I wrote, thankfully, he's not a virgin. And he mentions that. And thankfully, when he says that, due to the tea, she believes him.
But that could have been why the other dude was still alive in the jail cell.
That he was not a virgin as well?
Correct.
And she just kept him around to do it?
Maybe she might have had other things that she could
That's
do with
true.
That.
That's true. She considers this and we see that Gillis can go with the flow. Good. You'll know what to do then, she says. And then we get the intro. Finally, that was a long ass start to the show. I was like, dang, they're really going to town. Like scene after scene after scene after scene after scene. So then intro, which I think is my favorite some. Do you think it's like even hearing it over and over? Do you think it's your favorite out of all three seasons or the changes we heard?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yes, my heart. We have the intro that we both love. And then we get to see like a little bit left of the cold open or a relation to the cold open is a hand going through the treasure chest. And I wrote, hey, Bakra. Yo. Hey, girl. Now we have Claire's VO telling us that, yes, indeed, they are in Jamaica.
Well, we knew that they were, but we didn't know that the other ones joined in. For everyone who was saying over the last couple of weeks that with the adaptation and the things that they've cut for time, they were not sad that we didn't have to look at the slave market. Unfortunately, here's your slave market.
So they're in Jamaica. They're unloading the cargo from the Artemis as they promised Jared. And Fergus and Marsali are eating something. At least Marsali's eating something. And they're just like lovey-doveying it up. And then we see Claire. Oh, I will never be tired of being happy. I will never stop being happy of seeing her gray straight hair. It makes me so happy because, number one, it's real. Number two, it's the Claire. I say this over and over. And I know I say books, but I mean show because in the books, it's your brain. In the show, it's your eyes. This is the Claire. Let's say we get all the books and all the seasons. The point is Claire with gray and grayer hair because she doesn't get younger. This is the Claire we have for most of the series, for the huge amount of the series. So seasons one and two, books one and two are of 10 books is 20%. So 80%, the overwhelmingly huge majority of the story that we have, these two incredible characters, this beautiful story is with Claire. This is the Claire. This is the Claire, the grayish Claire and grayer later on. This is the Claire we have forevermore. And that's why I'm so happy because seeing it, even if we don't get all the seasons, I can imagine we might. And it just makes me so happy. But you like her gray hair too, right?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they keep it or if they have her invent Lady Clairol.
Oh, Summer. So they're planning how to best look for young Ian. She wants to split up and Jamie says, no, I'm not splitting from you again, Sassenach.
That's the smartest thing he's ever said. And it had nothing to do with her wandering off or, you know, not staying put. I think that what I was trying to say that came out completely the opposite was that every time he leaves her alone, bad things happen because she cannot be trusted on her own. She is a and my boyfriend called her this, and I'm like, this is true. She's a chaos monster.
I like that term.
Like chaos finds her and surrounds her, and she creates it if it's not there already.
The one like huge paragraph or huge like litany of things that I talk mostly in depth about is the scene at the slave market, because I did the exact same similar discussion of the exact same scene in the book. And I'm so happy they kept it, or at least a version of it. They kept the most like that you would recognize it. If you're a book reader, you would recognize that scene because it was very decently faithful, not exact, but decently faithful. Okay. So they meet another employee of Jared's named Kenneth MacIver, and from him they learn of the governor's ball that very evening, and he invites them. Kenneth says he will help them find lodging, and Jamie will tell him about young Ian on the way, because he mentions that they're looking for his nephew. They walk through the town. The Bruja, they find out, was indeed already there and had gone. Or had already been there and had gone. No idea where it was now, says Mr. MacIver. And he doesn't know if any white males were sold from the ship. So they're trying to find out what they can. He can't really help them except to say the Bruja has come and gone. Leslie, and then we flash to Claire, and Leslie has given her a parasol. Now, in the book, that was Stan, right?
What I do remember was her having the parasol and being like, I don't know why, you know, they gave it to her because all the white women have them. And then her being like, I don't need this because I'm a white woman. And then all of a sudden being like, it's hot, y'all. I need this parasol.
Exactly. So Leslie gives her a parasol so that she may appear respectable. And she doesn't care, really. And she folds it up right away. And then she sees they're in the market. She sees the slaves that are for sale. They go through the slave market. And obviously, just as we knew it would be, I mentioned this like almost verbatim from our read along of Voyager. It is horrific what we see of it. In the book, one of the most touching and grotesque things that we saw or were told about was this burning ground, the burning grounds, right? So the slaves that had died on the journey from Africa to the Indies were burned if they weren't turned overboard. But the ones who were or thrown overboard. That's a good question. Why wouldn't they have been thrown overboard? But whatever. Whoever they discovered.
Because they probably didn't even open the cargo to check on
them.
Probably
just dumped down the food.
But this whole thing didn't happen on Jamaica. They offboarded someplace else, I believe. Because remember, they went and checked.
Oh, that's right. They got the slave and then went on the trip, on the ship. Yeah. And they put the slave in the hold just to be safe. Okay. Yes, you're right. So it wasn't on Jamaica. So yeah. They collapsed a lot of stuff. And for the sake of time, everything happens on Jamaica. We get it. So in the book, there was this slave market and it was awful. But there was also this place for the slaves that died during the passage. They would burn their bodies. And they had this huge place, like a, you know, I don't know how close to the market it was, but you could see the smoke probably for miles. And the stench was incredible.
I didn't miss it.
Oh, no. I didn't miss it like I needed to see it. But as far as drama, I think that would have been the only thing that would have been more dramatic than the slave market. And I think they did a fine job. They did the best they could, I think. And the reason that you could easily say, oh, there's the slave, the burning of the slave. There's no reason to include that. Even Diana, there was no reason for Diana to include that. The reason she did it.
It was just a you know, there's the reason she did it. It's a historical accuracy, A. And B, you know she likes to have a smell, a taste, and a sight.
But wanting to have a smell, a taste, or a sight is not enough to include something like that, I don't think. However, the historical stuff I would buy. So Diana wants to infuse your experience with as much as she can, right? Historically and sensorily?
Sensory-wise?
So basically, the reason she included it in the story, not in the description, because she didn't say, and they looked out and they saw the burning and they saw the market. No, she described it. But the reason she included it was because they went there. And the reason they went there.
Well, they were checking to see if Ian's body was among them.
Exactly. The reason they went there was to rule out the possibility, because it was a possibility, if because Ian had been on a ship and he was held prisoner, captive, whatever, in case he had died on the journey and his body as an indentured servant, he would have been sold into slavery or into servitude. There was a chance they just had to rule it out. And like Claire did not want to go. Jamie didn't want to, but he felt he had to. And it was a very touching, sad, disgusting, sensory wise scene that Diana did very well, as she does almost every scene. But yeah, so I agree with Summer. I didn't miss it, but it would have been, I think it would have been touching, because the reason they go there is to hopefully not find the dead body, but to look it out.
I think touching is not the word you want to use.
Not
there.
Touching to see dead bodies and burning. Touching for the fact that, or sad. Sad because sad and gross. But the touching part is because they're facing the real reality, the real fact that he might be dead.
That's not touching. Touching is like a feel-good moment.
I disagree. It is feel-good, but touching can also be sad.
Touching is a Hallmark movie comment.
And of course, then Jamie loses Claire. She's still at the market, and she's watching as a young female slave being branded. Now, that is, I think, also from the book. They get separated. She watches a female slave be branded, but I thought it was like just above her breast. I don't know if they showed the boobs in the show. They did it, but I don't know if they exposed her or not, but I think it was like on her chest above the breast. I could be completely wrong, but that's what I have the image in my mind. And then Claire goes along and there's an auction starting and she approaches. And this is Téméraire from the book. Now, someone mentions a Mistress Abernathy, who had a huge slave who never produced offspring. And someone in the crowd wants assurances that this slave, the one who's being auctioned, will, unlike the one Mrs. Abernathy had, be able to sire children. So we get this reference again to a Mistress Abernathy. So the auctioneer, to show how able this, I guess you would have called him a stud.
Well, he was injured. He was not field worthy because they couldn't put him out in the fields because he was injured.
So to show that he was able, he began to, and this is directly from the book, massage his member. Now, in the book, he actually did. I don't know how far he got in the book, but he actually did. In the show.
In the book, he was naked to begin with. So they at least gave him a loincloth.
Thank goodness.
That, and I'm pretty sure that you can't show that on TV.
Oh, exactly. I almost said, genau.
I don't care how MA you are.
No. I don't know how, forget MA. I don't care how stars you are. Stars is a whole new level of MA. Again, if you've seen Spartacus, you know what I'm talking about.
They still can't show hard penises, though.
Well,
they can talk about it all they want.
Supposed to. Well, they're,
tell us what they're going to do with it.
In the episode of season one of Spartacus called Whore, there was something that was not limp, that was covered in gold. That's all I'm saying. It could have been fake, but it was not limp. That's all I'm going to say.
It was fluffed.
Oh, Summer. No. Let's not talk about the dead like that.
The dead?
Andy Whitfield played Spartacus in season one.
It's a porn term, Ginger. I'm not talking ill
Summer,
of the dead.
I know what it means. I'm saying let's not talk ill of the dead. I'm not ill. Let's
How
not
is
talk
that
about
ill
dead,
if you so. Were if you were admiring his member?
My lips, Summer, I was not admiring his member.
You clearly were.
I didn't admire it. I saw a member.
You have fond memories of it.
Summer. So to show how able he was, as I said, the auctioneer began to like massage the member, or at least attempt to massage. And this is where Claire snaps, just like in the book. Okay. This is where she, in the book, as well as here on screen, snaps. And it's a situation that very well could have been extremely dangerous for them both and not just the slave. This is, as I said in our read-along discussion about this chapter, where Claire finally learns, internalizes, etc. Finally, where it hits home that going forward, not only isn't she in the 20th century anymore, she's not in 18th century Scotland anymore either. Here, where slavery thrives, her speaking out, let alone acting out, can get slaves killed at worst and beaten at best, can get her, Jamie, and those they know and love arrested. As devastating as slavery must have been for her to experience visually, as much as it goes against everything in her, whatever the century, whatever the place, here in front of the auctioneer where she breaks character, and I don't mean the writers are portraying here, as I said before, when Jamie kind of broke character. I'm not talking about that. Where she breaks her own character and dares to speak out, or I should say breaks a character that an 18th century white European woman should have had, right, at the time, and dares to speak out, to attempt to help the slave. She learns to keep quiet. Eventually. This has much more meaning in later books, but since they are in the New World, it's not a spoiler to say that this is the age of slavery in this part of the world, and this is where they are and where they remain, where they will be. As she tells Jamie, it won't be abolished in the colonies, in America, for many years to come. She tells him this later. Though we experience it only in this one brief scene, this has a huge connotation for Claire, and Claire alone. Jamie, while he may not have been around black slaves before, knows about it and can accept it as part of the time and culture. He may not approve, he may not want to own one, but he knows better than to act out. He knows that people can be beaten, killed, arrested, etc., much as he knew when he had to, quote-unquote, correct Claire, so her or their status could be reinstated after she escaped and put them all in danger when she was captured and taken to BJR in early season one. I'm not saying she makes 100% smart decisions from now on. After all, this is Claire, as Summer said, chaos monster. Or as Summer's boyfriend said, chaos monster. But she is understanding, finally, that her actions affect others, and be it belt or allowed talking to, would be mightily welcomed in comparison to the new dangers in this new world. Dang, Samalama. She goes to town with that parasol. I love it. I wonder what the slave thought. Like, here's this white woman. WTF? Claire, crying, begs Jamie to do something to help him. So he does really the only thing he can do. He buys him. Now, what I thought was funny was that he buys him in her name. He could have put his own name. Come on. But he puts it in her name. I think the reason he did that was so that, not because she wanted a slave, but so that she would have that freedom, even though he would certainly, if he had bought it in his name, he would certainly have done as she wished, I believe, because this was all done for her. But I think the reason he put it in her name was to give her that feeling of, look, I have the power to free you. That's why I think he did it. Her first response, we have to free him. But then, as I said, this whole thing in the slave market, it's just happened. It's fresh in her mind. And even though she says, we have to free him, she does see sense. This is Claire showing that she is starting to finally, after 20 plus years, internalize that she may not, maybe what she wants to do and what is best for this person or for herself or for whomever may not be the best course of action, at least at the moment. She sees sense. If they release him, he'll be recaptured or sold to lesser owners, if you will. She wants to tear up the bill of sale and keep him as a companion. But then Jamie says they'll have no proof they own him, leaving him in danger to be claimed by others. They agree to set him free when they can, when it's safe. So they're going to do right by him as well as they can, but they have to bide their time. It can't be right. It can't be that gut reaction. Claire is learning. Finally learning. And then they're going to the ball. They take Temeraire to the ball so that he can potentially get information for them about young Ian from the other slaves. Because slaves, as any and all servants who are eyes and ears, but, you know, not supposed to speak up to their masters unless spoken to, or their employers, but as servants are in Britain, in America, right? They are eyes and ears, and they will gossip, but at the very least, they will have information. So he agreed to do his best to ask around. Jamie asks Temeraire about young Ian. Oh, and I just said this. He says, please come with us, ask around for us, and then we'll let you go. We will be indebted to you. Please help us. And then we are at Rose Hall. Bakra needs the missing stone. She apparently needs all three stones for a final reading. Now, she is speaking, of course, with Archibald Campbell, and they have combed over the prophecy of the Brachan Seer, she says. Remember this, dear listener. Book readers will know all about this treasure. Slightly changed for the inspired TV show. I'm going to say an inspired TV show rather than an adaptation. Adaptation is not incorrect. I'm being a little bit facetious here because it's Crazy Town changed certain things. But the characterization stuff and then the lack of showing stuff on screen where necessary. All of that stuff. I now consider this series inspired by the book series. It has elements of Outlander. It has the characters. It has like the main high points, which we're seeing in this episode. The word that sits well better with me in my gut is now inspired by. As I've heard or read other people say, or actually Summer, you're like the person whom I've heard say it the most, is because of Butterfly Effect. They are now dealing with, or they dealt with, had to deal with changes they made early on. And those tiny changes, for example, showing Claire the Willy portrait.
Don't pause there.
Sorry. Telling Claire about Willy. And that's very small, actually. It doesn't change the larger storyline. That's not a big thing. But telling Claire about Willy and not having, because now we can say it, our friend was Lord John, not having our friend on the porpoise. So those two together, as soon as you told her about Willy, it didn't matter if he's on the porpoise or not, because you lost the effect of the amazing scene at the governor's ball. You lost it. So having him on the porpoise was, I missed it. Like, I would have loved to have seen it, but it was like neither here nor there because you lost the end, which was not the porpoise. The end was in the governor's ball when they spoke in private, which anyway. So my point is I enjoyed 312 immensely, but the governor's ball is a perfect example of it was, I don't even know if it would be a 180. Can you get further away from than 180? I saw the main things. I saw the things, but Summer, you said it exactly before. This is the result. This is an example of on purpose changes, but also, oh my gosh, what are we going to do because we did this 5 episodes earlier? That's Butterfly Effect. I think it was very enjoyable. I really did like this episode, but I think it was a perfect example of Butterfly Effect because of the things that happened in 306 and other episodes. Anyway, so all of that was to explain back to how I started was the word inspired. We hear a little bit more about this thing, about this seer, this prophecy. It's slightly changed for this inspired TV show. The prophecy states that a seer must hold all three stones, and she means, of course, these sapphires, at the same time to find out when a new Scottish king will rise. Margaret Campbell says that the treasure was born of blood and death. And she kind of says it under her breath to her brother, and Galus overhears it-ish and asks, what did she say? And then he's like, oh, no, nothing. So he is, at the end of the day, he uses his sister. Do not get me wrong. He absolutely uses her, but he does want to protect her. He does not want to get her hurt or killed.
He wants to be the one who has the option to hit her with a stick.
Well, that's true.
He's like, you want me to hit you with a stick again?
But Summer, he wouldn't kill her. She is his bread and butter. And
he would not kill her. No, he needs her because he has no discernible talents.
Yeah, exactly. But the Bakra might kill her. That's what I'm saying. The Bakra doesn't give a Okay? The Bakra doesn't give a So how did she hear about the jewels? This is all new to us too, dear listener. The Bakra says that they were handed down from father to son for generations, until they came to Dougal Mackenzie, who then hid them on the Selkie Island. Now, Archibald Campbell wants the rest of the treasure, and Galus, the Bakra, she's like, I don't care. I only care about the stone, but you won't get anything until I get that stone and we get this prophecy, we get this reading. It's finally ball time. So out, they arrive at the ball. Out of the carriage comes a bewigged Jamie, and then Claire in a redone gown from her Paris month, her Paris year. She wasn't there for a year, so of her Paris years, months, excuse me, months. And it's gorgeous. Marsali says that Jamie looks like a dandy, and he kind of does. Fergus, of course, looks French. Marsali is adorable, and Mr. Willoughby looks pretty hot. Not going to lie. Gary Young's kind of hot. So I'm not going to mention most of any changes because I'd get whiplash thinking about them. I'd get whiplash thinking about them, blind reading them, and you'd go deaf listening. So, but the first coinky dink, not in the book, they meet Mr. Archibald Campbell at the ball. She was Malcolm, and now she's Fraser. He seems just a little suspicious. Now, as they enter, we're listening to this beautiful classical music, and Claire's looking around, and she notices the slaves. And I'm sorry to say, and she knows this, and she even tells Jamie this. Sorry, Claire, dear, it's not going anywhere anytime soon. Unless you take a trip back through the stones, you will be having slaves around you, or at least in your world, the rest of your life. A woman comes up to Jamie and asks him if Mr. Willoughby is real. And he turns on the charm. And then she says, oh, it even speaks English. Yeah, that's kind. He's an attraction, unfortunately. Across the room, Mr. Willoughby sees Margaret Campbell. Seems to be giving a reading to a slave, I think. She tells the slave that one day he will be free, or his people, his kind, will be free of the shackles that bind them. And she's telling fortunes without his brother's permission. Her brother's permission. She makes eye contact with Mr. Willoughby. Now, do you think she kept eye contact? First of all, they made eye contact. That's not blaming anything or anyone. But just because you make eye contact doesn't mean you keep eye contact. Now, they kept it. Do you think she was immediately smitten? Or at least just, or looking at him because he was just different. At first, she just saw him and he noticed, of course, he was different.
He looked smitten.
Yeah, I would not disagree.
And probably from across the room, she looked really friendly with the servants or the slaves. Servants is not the real case. I'm just saying with the help. She looked really friendly with the help, which might have been like, ooh, this one's different. This one might give me the time of day.
Exactly. Because he hasn't found woman who has allowed him to lay with her yet. So we shall see. Jamie and Claire are waiting in line to meet the governor. Jamie mentions how they used to be in public.
How he and Claire used to act in public was a lot like Fergus and...
Say, thank you so much. I was not making that connection. Okay. And Jamie mentions how he and Claire used to be as lovey-dovey as Fergus and Missali in public. The music here is gorgeous. Maybe a tiny, I could not really, really easily make it out, but I'm thinking, because they have like a long time stare at each other there with no dialogue. I think it was the love theme.
I had the love theme at one point.
Good. So a second coinky dink. Then Jamie sees Lord John, our friend. Seeing Lord John and him, I'm not going to lie, made me tear up. However they are brought back together, theirs is a lifelong friendship. He introduces Claire to Lord John. And Lord John asks, oh, well, how did Claire return? And they say, it's a long story.
He's not wrong.
Gosh, no. It's a 20-year story. It's a very long story.
Statistically, it's taken her at least an entire evening to tell the story. Like from sundown to sun up the following day, statistically. But that's just the portion of when she goes back in time the first time. She has to add 20 years to that.
That's true. So Governor John, His Excellency says that they should go speak in private. So they all go off to his office. Now, third coinky dink, Galus sees them from across the room. Wowza. This is not only a change, it's like a 180. I mean, it doesn't take the storyline in a different direction because it's all going toward the same direction. So maybe 180 is not correct, like a 90-degree shift. Who knows? But Mrs. Abernathy was regarded with fear and awe in the books. She apparently didn't get out much, but here she is. So there you go. The music here that plays when we see her, kind of freaky, a little dissonant. And I've mentioned it before, music we heard when we saw her. And this music reminded me of the music, or sound effects, whatever you want to call it, music from Lost, a little bit.
The TV show?
Yeah. So I think we'll hear this again. There's a lot of dissonance in Lost too. I think we'll hear this again, the music. In the governor's office, Lord John asks if Jamie is all right. Jamie responds, is Willie here? You know what he's thinking about.
Right.
Claire knows Claire. They admit that, yes, Claire knows. She's been told everything. Speak freely, dude. Stop wasting time. We find out that Willie and Isabel are to join Lord John later that summer. And as they're talking about it, Willie's theme plays. I wanted to like hum.
Only you. Legitimately, only you noticed that. And Bear.
Okay, Bear, yeah. I'm sure others did. And dude, that small boy, he still remembers him. So sad. Here's my only note about this scene. The only thing I do mourn, and many people have said this, and that is they mourn the amazing dialogue, scene, whatever, between Lord John Grey and Claire, who have a great discussion in the book where they basically try and one-up each other with, I'm more meaningful to Jamie because. That to me is, that was the victim of them deciding to have Jamie tell Claire about Willie early on. That's it. So in the office, Jamie tells Lord John why they're there. They are indeed trying to find young Ian, his nephew. Lord John wants to help. Claire asks that he introduce them to some of the landowners on the island. As Lord John's jacket pops open, Jamie sees the sapphire he'd given him on a decorative piece of fabric. And he says it was, quote, to remember our friendship. Uh-huh. And Lord John takes his leave. And they also, Jamie and Claire, return to the party. And of course, alcohol. Then Kenneth MacIver introduces Jamie to a Freemason. And Claire wanders off. Outside, we see Margaret Campbell sitting alone, and Mr. Willoughby approaches. I do love this Willoughby. I do. He tells her that Archibald, or her brother, doesn't seem to treat her well. And we hear Yi Tian Cho's theme, or the music that plays with him many times. Margaret tells him, you are a rare soul. Now, I'm wondering, do you think they're building us up for Margaret going off with Yi Tian Cho?
It's very possible. It would give a reason for the both of those two characters to stay in Jamaica.
Exactly. To disappear together. Absolutely. He calls her flower from heaven. Back inside the party, Claire is approached by the governor, by Lord John. And this is basically what I took from this is what they gave us. This is the Lord John Grey Claire scene. This is what we get. Lord John Grey, the new governor, approaches Claire. Now, they're drinking, but I just love the glasses they drink out of. I need to get it like a set of those, an entire set of those glasses. So Lord John reminds her that they had met before the rising. He was quite young. She knows and she remembers that it was outside of or near Carriarrick before the rising. And she says to him that she knows about Willie. And about Geneva. Lord John looks a little bit perturbed. So we get the reason I said they gave us this instead of or in lieu of the wonderful book scene in the book where they kind of one up each other. This is a very like maybe a 2% version of that, maybe a 10%, not even a 10, but this is like a 1 or 3% version of that as far as the one upmanship. And Lord John looks a little perturbed and a little surprised. He says, oh, he's told you a great deal. Claire asks for confirmation. Jamie gave you that sapphire? He says, yes. So this is a wee bit, as I said, of their awesome scene in the book. It's nothing like it as far as what they say, how they go about it. But it's in essence, in spirit, they are trying to one-up each other at least a teensy weensy bit. But it is funny. And it's kind of a tiny bit of a pissing match, but not really. The governor tells Claire that he was searching for her. He says he relays that Jamie had been searching for her. And Claire says that, yeah, I know this too, dude. Lord John says that when he was searching for her, specifically, he didn't say when he was an escaped prisoner, but that's what he meant, of course, that when he was looking for her, when he escaped and was looking for her on the Selkies Island, he says he believed, meaning Jamie, he believed you might have come back to him. And now you have. And Claire replies with a straight face, yes, I have. That is the climax of the two of them having a pissing match. It's not that strong, but it's as much as we're going to get. I'm a little sad here. When he says it was nice to finally meet the love that made his heartbeat, meaning Jamie's, I think he had a little bit of a sheen in his eyes. And then we get the Druid theme, and you know you better watch out. Claire looks up, and she sees Galus. She's like, gotta run, Gov. Talk soon.
I feel really bad for Lotta for having legitimately the worst wig of the episode.
Oh, gosh. It wasn't the best wig,
was it? It was awful. I was like, ugh.
I can't believe it. Especially, she's supposed to be like some richy bitchy, so she should be able to have, like, better than Claire's even. Come on now.
Claire's was her hair.
Well, maybe.
It was supposed to be her hair, and it was just styled. Whereas Galus had a really strange, ill-fitting, like, it didn't even look like it was hers. It looked like she stole it from somebody.
Huh.
Like, it didn't look like it fit her head. It didn't match her hairline. It was very obviously a wig.
At weird,
and it did
angles
not
sometimes.
Go with her head.
Yeah. And you have to appreciate the line that Claire says, quote, "I believe I've seen a ghost," unquote. In season one, episode one, it's Frank that says this almost verbatim after coming into Mrs. Baird's inn and relaying what he'd seen in the street below to Claire. Of course, that was Jamie. And Galus has an awesome line. She has a few zingers in this episode, a few anachronistic lines. She says, "Of all the gin joints in all the towns, in all the world." Straight, quotes our Bakra, straight from Casablanca. And we'll include a link to a short version of that scene in the show notes. "I thought you were dead." Galus retells what happened to her after the witch trial. She was put back in the thieves' hole, gave birth, however, to her child in her own bed in the fiscal's house. Dougal bribed people to make sure the person dragged to the pyre the next day wasn't her. It was old Granny Joan McClellan. Quote, in response to Claire saying, you saw the burning, you saw the pyre, she said, quote, "Wouldn't have missed it. No one gets to witness their own funeral, let alone their own execution," unquote. Dougal found a home for the bairn and got her away. No mention of where she was hiding out, however. Now, in the book, and this is not important, but in the book, specifically, at least for a time, we don't know exactly when it happened, but at least for a time, she was in France, in Paris, to be exact. And she was in Paris while Claire and Jamie were in Paris. That's just a nice little FYI, but that's completely not important. After Culloden, when she found out Dougal died, she eventually married a man named Abernathy, a sugar plantation owner and filthy rich, who later died. And Galus goes on about, oh, how this area and this climate and blah, blah, blah is so bad for European men, blah, 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 blah. Okay, I wonder how he died. Come on.
You know she killed him. You know she killed him.
The funny thing is, and this is, again, probably to save time, although it's just talk because they never show a dude. So whether it's one dude or three dudes, I don't think that would have, I don't care, but it wouldn't have, again, it's just words on paper. It doesn't matter whether it was one husband or three. But in the book, if I'm not mistaken,
she was like the Black Widow.
Well, yeah, but Abernathy wasn't, she didn't just marry one dude.
I think Abernathy was just the latest in a line of dudes she was murdering.
Probably the latest, yes. But I don't think she moved to Jamaica. I mean, she may have moved to Jamaica to marry him, but I got the, in the book, if I'm not mistaken, she married more than one person after the witch trial. She went around. Now, that may have not all happened on Jamaica, but she didn't like hide out and then suddenly move to Jamaica to marry Abernathy. That's what I remember. I could be wrong, but I don't believe it was only Abernathy. I thought it was a few. Clara thanks her still for saving her life. But she hasn't said that she actually went back in time yet. Did you notice that? She never mentioned traveling, going home, going back to the future. That's important. The reason that's important is because when they do the reading, Galus has no clue. If Claire had mentioned, or if she knew Claire had gone back to the future and then come back, regardless of what may have happened in the interim, she may have had an inkling of something. So she mentions that they're looking for young Ian, and Galus, the actress, offers to help. Oh, well, let me help you find da-da-da-da-da. What are friends for? Right here, when she says that, there's that odd music again. It's dissonance, but also just funky town. And I mentioned earlier, and I think we're going to have it the rest of season three. And by yes, by rest, I mean for the next episode. Now, she says, what a beautiful necklace. that Claire's wearing. She asks about it, and Claire says, oh, it's black coral from Jamie. Gayla says, well, let's go see the Wee Fox Club. Now, I love this. Is this in the book at all? Not at all.
No, but it's a callback to season one.
Yes, but what I'm saying is in the book, which is completely different, right? This conversation right now-ish happens at Rose Hall. But she calls him in Rose Hall in front of Claire, the Wee Fox Club. So the reason I love it is because even though this is a completely different conversation, although the same kind of strain, kind of the same point, she's still being nicey-nicey with her. And a version of this did happen in the book. Well, the conversation happened in the book. This is a version of that.
How Claire doesn't catch on to how off Galus is.
Girlfriend, Claire's always been off. Or Claire's always been apparently thick-headed when it comes to Galus. Or not always, but too late, too little too late is what it is. Back at the party, Claire is thrilled to see Jamie and Lord John schmoozing. Here's Galus. Galus meets Lord John, and then she sees and grabs the gemstone he's wearing. Yes, it was found off the coast of Scotland. She doesn't care. She's like, once she sees what it is, she's like, I know what it is now because this matches what young Ian, or her blonde-haired non-virgin little boy she slept with. She goes to find her people and plan the raid. By the way, the purple flower in Claire's hair looks like a plumeria. I could be completely wrong, but the only way I can even guess that is because I bought a fake one to clip in my hair in our trip in Hawaii earlier this year, and then I lost it. And then I was so like upset because I love the way it looked purple, obviously, and then I love the way it looked that I bought another one that was, I think, smaller, and then I found the first one. I thought I lost, and now I have two. So I have two in my bathroom that I look at every single day. And so I will have to maybe wear one or both on our live after show. And every time Claire turned her head and I saw that purple, I went, my clip-on plumeria. Galus wants Margaret to do a reading for the crowd. She wants one reading. The reading starts. The governor approaches and she insists that he oblige the crowd by being part of it. Margaret has the two stones, the two sapphires, and she says she can feel that what she's telling Archibald, her brother, this. She feels that what is about to happen will bring death. Now, Galus, coming forward with the governor, says that the reader needs something personal to hold. And it just so happens it could be the stone that he has. Then we get the reading. I gotta say, when Margaret starts out and she like has that little funny focus look on her face, it's kind of funny. I'm not gonna lie. I laughed. Here's what she said and what was transcribed by Archibald. When twice 1,200 moons have coursed tween man's attack and woman's curse, and when the issue is cut down, then will a Scotsman wear a crown. Okay, I've got it. But I won't spoil. Now, even if you're not a book reader, if you're a book reader, you know already. If you're not a book reader and you listen to this and it confused you, but then even when they kind of, when she explained it or at least put it into more understandable words, like, okay, so 200 years instead of 1,200 moons, and then a man, you know, plants his seed, a woman gives birth in 200 years, an infant or a baby or a child issue that is 200 years on the day of its birth, all that. If you're a book reader, this is like super obvious, hyper obvious. But if you're not, you may not have gotten all of that, obviously. But the 200 years, if nothing else, the 200 years should have clicked something. I'm not going to say anything more, but that should have clicked, hopefully. Back at the party, Lord John's all, okay, let's get on with the show.
Most awkward reading ever.
Totally. Because it really had nothing to do with him. But whatevs. So Galus grabs Campbell and they go outside. She's not happy. She's like, you tell me what's going on here. And he says it means that 200 years between a child's birth and planting one seed. And the issue is the child. And she goes on about Benjamin Button. I love all the anachronistic stuff. It just makes me laugh.
I had to look that up because I was like, what year is that? Because all I could think of was the movie, but it's based on a book from the 20s.
Archibald says it takes time for these things to develop and to really understand the meaning of these readings.
And she should have responded, you have one more episode.
Exactly. She responds, time? I have. Which, I mean, I guess. So outside, Fergus and Marsali are smooching against the tree. That was very sweet. And I love seeing their relationship develop. I think this music, it might be their theme. Is there strings involved? It could just be pretty music. But it's got strings, which is evocative of the French court or, you know, French classical music or classical music, period, I should say, which would be definitely more of Fergus than Marsali. But it's not developed very far because the scene's not very long. We don't get a ton of these scenes with them, let alone thus a ton of this music. Thankfully, they're outside making out. And they see Captain Leonard as he arrives looking for Jamie. Back inside, Fergus tells Jamie and Claire that Captain Leonard is there. And Jamie and Claire and Willoughby and all their entourage make a run for it. They plan to get to the carriage and find Mr. Willoughby, but their slave, the one they bought, tells them that young Ian was actually seen. He was taken to a Mistress Abernathy at Rose Hall. Claire says, "Gaylis lied." I'm like, girlfriend,
duh.
Are you surprised? Woman, get off your patoot. I don't even know what to say. Get off your patoot. Temeraire says they can, so I've done my thing. You can drop me off over at here.
Seriously, just keep driving and I'll tell you where to drop me off.
Exactly.
And then, as one does. And then he wants them to drop them off at an inopportune place. And then they stand around there just long enough for the redcoats to catch up. Typical.
So the music here is gorgeous. Jamie and Claire stop to let the slave go free. And as Summer said, Jamie is captured by Captain Leonard and his men. But before he's taken, thankfully, he gives Claire the pictures of Brianna and the portrait miniature of Wee Willie.
The Bairns. He called them the Bairns. I loved it.
I know. And that's from the book too. It makes me so, oh man, that my heart goes, or my stomach just like warms. I love it. Claire stands off. There's like a standoff, but not really. Claire stands off. Leonard says, "Madam."
What an ass, man.
Dude. Jamie tells her to go and find young Ian. The music at the end is again that odd, dissonant, weirdo, freaky town, gross, nothing we like to hear music.
I'll tell Barry you said that.
The music that I just mentioned continues like during the closing credits. It goes on. It's bad. And then at some point, it reminded me of, I mean, not that I spend a lot of time underwater or anything, but it reminded me of, I don't know why, but it reminded me of Underwater. Underwater is usually quiet, so I don't know how that came in, but it reminded me, I don't know if it was some movie of people being underwater. I don't know. It just reminded me of some weird being underwater, something freakish, but that music is just probably the most dramatic thing of the episode. So that was 3:12 some.
Only one more before we, oh my gosh, before we start our read along. All right. So join us next week when we discuss episode 313 entitled Eye of the Storm.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.